Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes, or however long. We're never sure with these things. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the literary world. My guest today is Dr. William Stanford, who has just released an absolutely wonderful and powerful book, a biography of his parents' life during the Second World War. It's titled Litzy and Fredel. This book is a book with a twist, and it's a subject that I was previously unaware of. Litzy and Fredel were persecuted, but they were not Jewish. They were Roman Catholic Austrians. So, on with the show. Bill, hello and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Simon. It's my pleasure and I'm honored to be on it with you.
Well, I'm honored to talk to you. I think you have created just a marvelously powerful book, and one that I personally feel is going to do very, very well.
Thank you.
Let's start with a little biography. Can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Certainly. I was born in Paris, France, after the war, the result of my parents' survival. Then I immigrated with my mother and father to New York from France in 1950, when I was just a small boy of 4 years old. And we came there. I didn't realize the arduousness of what my parents had to go through, but they had attempted to immigrate to the United States from 1938 until 1950 18 times, and it was only on the 18th time that they were given approval to immigrate to the United States.
And actually, that's not quite true, is it? I thought they had received the go-ahead, but that there was a problem in that it was not just your parents, but it also had to include your father's brother and his wife.
That was actually the first. Yes, you're absolutely correct. The one of the first times when they attempted to do that, the documentation showed four people: my mother, my father, my mother's sister, who happened to be married. This particular sister happened to be married to my father's older brother, and all four names had to be, all of four people had to be able to report to the place of leaving in Le Havre in France, and of course, all of them were not available, so they were declined for that the very first time. But subsequent to that, they attempted an additional 16 times, if you will, and were denied until the 18th try.
Right.
So getting back to, so once we got to the United States, we moved back and forth from New York to California at least three times in each place, going back and forth. My father was a master jeweler, which I explain in the book, and he was in such great demand that he would be getting offers from the jewelry capitals of the world, if you will, New York being one of them, and the other one was Beverly Hills, California. And as a result of his expertise, he was in great demand, and so my father always wanted to better himself, and so we literally moved from New York to California to New York to California to New York to California. And then I finished my high school years in California and college, and then went on to optometry school at Southern California College of Optometry, where I became an optometrist in 1971.
Wow. Did your father make any jewelry for any of the rich and famous?
As a matter of fact, he did. One time while he was in Beverly Hills, a woman came in and asking to have a watch made, but she didn't want it to look like a watch. She wanted to make it look as if it were a bracelet. And my father was really an artist besides his craft as a master jeweler. So she gave him the idea of what she had in mind, and so then he made an actual drawing of it, a sketch, and then made it in a full color drawing. For her approval, she came back in, and she said, "That's exactly what I want." And as you look at the watch, you would see that it was a Florentine finish on the 14-karat gold portion of it, and it had what looked like a rose petal on top with diamonds that were studded throughout, and it was on a spring. And you opened up this little spring-hinged rose petal, and inside was a watch that was a Swiss movement that they got, but it looked like just a piece of jewelry. And most people will probably recognize her name. When she came in and it was finished, she loved it. And of course, they had to relinquish all the drawings my dad had made, as well as the model that he had to make himself to pour the gold in, so he could literally make each little part of the bracelet by hand. It was all handmade.
Wow.
And then everything was given to this actress. You probably will recognize her name. Her name was Elizabeth Taylor.
Wow. Indeed, the rich and famous.
Yes, yes. There were others that he dealt with, but, you know, the TV people and actors and actresses, but he really didn't share all of that with me, but he was especially proud of that one particular piece.
Right. From talking to you earlier, it seems that this has been a project that you've wanted to do for a very, very long time.
Indeed.
But your parents were somewhat reluctant to talk about their wartime experiences.
Correct. I probably, when I was very young, and you're in the elementary school years, and you become aware of world wars as you learn in history, and then I realized probably when I was in my early teens that, you know, you learn about World War II, and then so I would ask my parents a question because there was a blank, there was a missing piece of my heritage. All I knew of was the time of when I was born, and from that time forward, I never heard of anything that took place prior to that. And of course, everyone is kind of quizzical about their roots, and so I would ask my mom and dad about you know, what happened before that. Where were you during the war? And they would say, well, you know, you're a little too young to know about that. When you're a little bit older, we'll talk to you about it. I was probably about 12 or 13 at the time when I probably first think I asked about that. And then when I got to be 16, 17, 18 years old, and I start to think again about my roots, and I would ask the same question, and my father would basically put me off and say, well, not right now. This isn't the right time. Maybe sometime I'll tell you about it. And by that time, after you ask the same question repeatedly, you know, a dozen times, and as most children would ask their parents, and the parents say, not now, not now, you kind of learn to ignore that, and you say, okay, forget it. I'm not interested. And, of course, at that time, I had other interests. There was school, there was athletics, and there were girls, and so didn't occupy my time so much anymore. Until several years later, after I graduated from optometry school, I volunteered for the draft and served as a captain in the Army in the Medical Corps, and I was stationed at Fort Leonard, Missouri. And at that place, we were actually towards the end of the Vietnam War. We didn't know that at the time, but it was winding down. But in the hospital where I worked, you would see young men, some of them without limbs, some of them without arms or legs, some of them without their minds intact anymore from the rigors of war, much the same as we're seeing today in Iraq and Afghanistan. All wars are basically the same. And it occurred to me that there was so much trauma, much of it was mental as opposed to the physical things. The physical things you learn to be able to somehow compensate in your mind and you go on, but the mind is a little bit different. And it occurred to me my parents must have suffered terribly during the war since I knew that they were in France, and how did they get from Austria to France? And I knew there was some stories that needed to be, you know, told and for me to hear. This was 1973 discharged from the military, and then I start asking more questions. Well, 1973 rolls around. Again, I'm getting the same refrain. Maybe not now, maybe next week. My two daughters are born. My first daughter was born in Fort Leonard Wood, and she was a tiny infant when we moved back to California. And then my second daughter was born several years later. And then you have a family, and it's not a priority anymore. But we had kind of a tradition, and it started out innocently enough when both my daughters were very young. Grandma and Grandpa, as they were known by my daughters, would come over on a Friday afternoon, pick them up from school, and so we didn't need a babysitter on Fridays for my daughters. And they would come over, and Grandpa would be the horsey that the kids would ride around the coffee table, and Grandma would be the one that would teach them how to cook and how to bake, and she would make this wonderful French meal or this wonderful Viennese meal, and we had this Friday night as family night. And, of course, as we would sit around the table and we would all kind of share experiences and stories of the day and the week, when dinner was over, the kids would typically be excused. They'd want to go and play or do their homework or just kind of watch TV. And there would be something on TV that would provoke kind of a stimulus to my dad. It would be a news program of some sort, and my dad would say, that he were just talking about this place in France, and I was in a concentration camp close to that. And I would say, Dad, tell me about that. You've got to tell me about that. You've never spoken about that. And he would say, typical. I mean, this was almost the repetition every week. He'd say, not now, not now. This isn't a good time. The kids are here. They're too young to hear this. Maybe next week, maybe next week. So we go from 1973, 1974 to 1998. So 25 years of this, every Friday night without fail, unless someone was ill, they would come over and we'd have the same kind of, discussion periodically, and something else came on TV. Now my kids have grown up in these 25 years and I'd say, Dad, you've got to tell me about this. And he says, no, not now. Maybe next week. I said, Dad, you've been telling me that for over 25 years. There may not be a next week. And he looked at me with a look on his face that I had never seen before, and I didn't know what to expect. He sat back in the chair, and it was almost a look of, oh, my God, I've been putting this off for 25 years. And he said, you're right. I've got to tell you this. I've got to start telling you what had happened. And I think he recognized, or at least what I had stated to him, kind of sparked a remembrance that we all have our own mortalities to face, and they were now in their, he was probably about 87, 88 years old at that time, and in frail health, as was my mother, who was a year younger, and he recognized that the truth that I had spoken, and that, indeed, we better start doing this or it's going to be too late.
Right.
That's kind of a long version of the story of how I got him to tell me that.
When the story finally came out,
yes.
Were you shocked by what they had experienced?
Oh, absolutely. I was dumbfounded when I found out all these different stories. And what was difficult in this was people's memories, I found out. And, of course, bear in mind, this is 1998 when I'm first hearing these stories, and the war has been over since 1945. So we're talking about many, many decades later. People's memories do not come back in chronological order. They come back in bits and pieces. And so I knew I had a 15,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, and I was only getting a couple hundred pieces at a time, and so I kind of literally had to just document what they had said and then try to fill in the pieces. And oftentimes when I, have to recollect or try to get my parents to recollect what took place, there were parts of that are in the book that they did not remember. And then all of a sudden I could see in the interviews that we had, I could see a transformation in both of their faces as they remembered a horrendous episode of their lives and was very difficult for them. I could see the emotions taking place in their faces and in their body language that this is a very, very difficult thing to have to come back and remember. And I suspect that's why my dad kept putting me off, trying to protect my mother, trying to protect himself, I think, psychologically, so they wouldn't have to relive these horrendous moments of their lives.
I I have to admit, though, that they did remember an awful lot. I mean,
yes.
I find the book to be riveting reading, you know, in its detail. I mean, there's some great detail about the events and how they unfolded. As I understand it, while you were trying to put the research together, you attempted to introduce your father to some technology, but it didn't quite work out as planned.
No, actually, it's actually, I think, a very poignant and just wonderful story that I love and makes me laugh every time I think about it. When we were trying to do the interviews, initially I did them on one-on-one on Friday afternoons, Saturday mornings. I would go sometimes to their house on Sundays. We'd go back and forth. And I found that to be kind of arduous to kind of dictate, or excuse me, to write down what they had said. So I did audio tapes, and I did at my house and videotapes, and then realized that, you know, there's another way of doing this. At their leisure, they could tape record things that they would remember, you know, things that would pop in their head, things that kind of got spurred from our discussions back and forth. And so I thought, okay, my dad did not like technology. As a matter of fact, as clocks and different things that we have in our homes change to digital, they have to be set forward at daylight savings time, and then, of course, you have to move them back in the fall. And it was actually kind of like a traditional thing. It was like a day or two before Thanksgiving, before daylight savings time, my dad would have this little brown cardboard box with all of the clocks from his house and all of the watches that he had so that I could either set them forward and back. He just did not like technology. So I thought, okay, I'm going to solve this problem. I got a little recorder that was going to be voice activated. He had to do absolutely nothing. All he had to do was speak. And as he started to speak, he could then retell what he had remembered or anything new that took place. So each week I would give him the tape recorder with a new tape inside. I had another tape recorder, so all he had to do was bring back the little tape, and he kept the recorder at the house. And he would come back, and 1 week later, he would hand me the tape, and I would give him another blank tape. He would go home. Next day, I would put my dad's tape in the recorder to listen to see what he had to say. And this is basically what I heard. And then nothing. Minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, nothing on it. I went through the whole tape. There was nothing on it. I thought, well, that's bizarre. That's strange. So I didn't think anything of it. Next Friday, when they came over for dinner, we exchanged tapes again, gave them another blank tape. I would listen to it the following week, and I would hear this. And then nothing, blank. There was nothing on the tape. Well, this went on for about 3-4 weeks, and I thought, this is absurd. This is getting ridiculous. There's nothing on the tape except my dad clearing his voice. So finally, when my dad came over again on the following Friday, I said, Dad, you know, I've been listening to the tapes, and there's nothing on it. I said, all I can hear you is, you know, you're clearing your voice. And he said, I was afraid to tell you. And I said, you're afraid to tell me what? He says, your tape recorder doesn't work. I went, what do you mean it doesn't work? I said, I've tested it out. It works just fine. He says, no. As soon as I clear my voice, a red light comes on, and then so I stop. And he thought that when the red light came on, that meant stop. And so he never said anything at all on the tape. All I got was his voice clearing on the tape and nothing on it. And I couldn't convince him that that the tape recorder was fine, so that didn't work out. So I probably have about 20 minutes of him clearing his voice.
Did you abandon the micro recorder after that?
Yes, I have two micro cassettes at my house. I got 20 of these little digital tapes you could buy in bulk with nothing on them, except my dad's clearing his voice.
That is a great story, and I have to admit that the first time you told me it, After I got off the phone, I just had to share it with my wife, and she just roared with laughter.
Yeah, it's really kind of an amusing thing, and it was an interesting. I thought it would be an interesting way of being able to get more information. I actually then made it even easier for them. As you know, you can when you call in your home, oftentimes your message recorder will say if you want to talk to Joe. Push mailbox 1. If you want to talk to Sally, push mailbox 2. So I dedicated mailbox 1 to my mom and dad, and I said, anytime you think of something that kind of stimulated your mind after we talked the night before, go ahead and just leave a recording on that. And that made it very easy for them. All I had to do is dial the phone number, and it was quite common. And when we would come home at night after being in the office, I would look at my little red light on my recorder, on my telephone recorder, and I would see a digital number of 8, 9, or 10 every night, things that they would remember. And that was a really kind of an interesting way of doing it, because then I could, now this 15,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, I was able to fill in the pieces, and then I would ask them questions more about that. And it's kind of interesting if you think about, if you think about your memories, and if I said to you, Simon, what was your 16th birthday like? And you go, oh my gosh, I can't think back happened.
I wouldn't have a clue.
Well, you know, and then if you said, well, maybe it would work better with a girl when I say 16th. Maybe the 21st birthday is more dramatic for men, but if I said your 21st birthday, because that would be legal drinking age, you may say, oh, wait a minute, I had all my cousins and all my friends that came over for a party. And then you might remember something later on saying, oh, wait, one of my friends slipped on a banana peel and fell down, and then he fell into the punch bowl, and we all started laughing. And one thing would trigger something else. And that, in turn, would say, oh, wait a minute, and I do remember my Aunt Bessie could make it because she had, you know, she ate too much the night before. And that would stimulate more thoughts, and that's exactly the process that I took with my mom and dad when they would give me these stories on the telephone messages, as well as in person and videotapes that I did. We were able to fill in the pieces more and more, and as I would write it, they would kind of review what I wrote and say, oh, wow, this is exactly what took place, and then I would either refine it or I would, you know, change whatever needed to be changing. But it was 2 years of note-taking before I actually attempted to start to write it, because I felt as though I didn't want to leave too many gaps, and I wanted to make this a flowing dialogue chronology of their lives.
Right. What I found interesting was the way that you did manage to join effectively two stories together.
Yes.
Because for a huge part of the war, they were separated.
Correct.
And you know the interactions between the pair were few and very far between for the most
Correct.
Part.
Correct. It was kind of like a Sleepless in Seattle type of a thing, you know, where they were separated. I had a dilemma on my hands. I wasn't quite sure when I first was starting to write how to do that, but I realized that if I were going to chronicle their stories in a seamless and chronological manner, I would have to alternate their stories in the chapters of the book. And with every other chapter, I had to devote to the experience of the other parent. And ultimately, I had to bring their respective stories together at the same point in time at the end of each pair of chapters so that there would be a good flow, so that, if you will, there would be a cliffhanger at the end of that particular chapter. Then I would flash back 3 months prior to that, and then, you know, if it was a three-month segment, and then keep you forward, so you would not get lost in the story, so that you would have a continuous flow. And each time when they were separate, their thoughts and prayers were with the other. So it was easy for me to kind of, I thought, segue into that scenario, but I thought I'd have to alternate the chapters that way. Otherwise, it would be, well, I couldn't see any other way in my mind. I tried different ways, and I thought this would be the best approach.
Oh, and I think it works magnificently. Your parents were not Jewish. And yet they were persecuted. They were Austrians. They were Roman Catholics.
Exactly.
Do you have any idea at all about how many people found themselves in the same situation that Lietzi and Fredel found themselves in?
From recounts of my parents' story, there were probably in Europe, because that's the only exposure, there were probably hundreds of millions of them. And that sounds like, oh, my, that's an exaggeration. But one of the things that you have to remember, and I wasn't aware of this, I was ignorant of this fact, indeed 6 million Jews were murdered in the concentration camps. That's the documentation that we get from historians, and I don't dispute that or even begin to think that my thinking is probably more than that, but that's what history has or historians have said. But in the loss of civilian lives in World War II, there were 47 million people who died in World War II. Now, those are the deaths. What about the people that didn't die? I'm sure you could probably treble that and quadruple that as to those who suffered terribly, of which my parents were two of those stories. And so that's a staggering number when you think about that. I've been on I've had book signings I had a book signing at Barnes & Noble bookstore. And during the course of the signing of the book, people would be in line waiting for me to sign the book. And, of course, some of them had already read the book and had brought the book in for me to sign, and some people were just buying it because some of the publicity that was newspaper articles that were written, like in the Orange County Register and the L.A. Times. And they would come up to me afterwards as I was signing the book, and they would thank me for the book. And I said, oh, it was my pleasure. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And quite often they would say, no, I did enjoy the book. It was unbelievable. I thought it was great. But I want to thank you for giving my family a voice. And I was dumbfounded. I thought, I'm sorry, I guess I don't understand what you're saying. And one of them would say, well, my great-grandparents or my grandparents were in Budapest, Hungary. And when the Nazis came into the town, they were murdered in the street because they were in the street. They were Catholic. And I would get a story about someone from Czechoslovakia with aunts and uncles, and they were Protestants, and they were murdered because of something that took place. And so I was getting stories from people who said their stories or their families were kind of never really mentioned in a lot of the books and movies that were made, and they were not Jewish. And indeed, I don't care what denomination you are, whether you're Jewish, Protestant, or atheist for that matter. If you have a family member that was either murdered or persecuted or were tortured, their blood and their tears and their heartache is just as real as anybody else's, regardless of where you are from or what denomination or religious persuasion you're from.
Right. What, your parents did find some acts of kindness, you know, from individuals.
Yes.
But on the whole, the French government, government's treatment of them was nothing short of appalling.
Yes. When war broke out in September of 1939, my father and his two brothers were basically arrested. They were not aware that they were going to be arrested. Rumors had been talked about that there was going to be an Austrian Legion being formed.
Right.
And this Austrian Legion was going to be part of the French army to fight against Nazi Germany. France and Great Britain declared war on Germany. Shortly thereafter, this Austrian Legion supposedly was a ruse. Once they reported to a military base, and my father was totally in favor of this. He wanted to fight against the Nazis. So when they reported as they were instructed to do, they found themselves being arrested. The Austrian Legion was not being formed, and what was being done was these Austrians were being arrested as basically traitors to Nazi Germany. The Vichy government at this point in time had taken hold in France, and when France basically lost a lot of skirmishes in battle against Germany, rather than have their country destroyed, they basically acquiesced to the will of Nazi Germany and Hitler, and a new government was formed called the Vichy government. And they were basically collaborationists now with the Nazis. And they were the ones that interned my father and put him in concentration camps and all of the terrible things that took place to all of the men who were Austrians. There was two factions in France at the time. One was the Vichy government, and the other was the French loyalists, the French underground, or the FFI, as they were called, which is Force Française Intérieure. And they were kind of like the Minutemen of the United States. They were unofficial. They were a ragtag group of organized civilians, if you will, and fought as hard as they could against the Nazis. And it was the French loyalists that at every chance they could, that they would help my mom and my dad when the opportunity arose. So, yes, there were a lot of... The government itself at that time, before they were overthrown by Charles de Gaulle near the end of the war, were terrible to my father and to my mother.
Yes. I mean, it's horrible. And people that are listening to the show, I really cannot recommend this book enough. It is a completely different view of France than you have ever read before in the history books. Let's talk a little bit about the world of publishing. I talk to a lot of first-time authors, and many of them get pretty bitter when asked about the industry. You've got agents, publishers, editors, and they all in their own way add layers of complexity to the process.
Right.
You know, so many authors set out with the if you build it, they will come approach, you know,
right.
Thinking the tough bit is writing the book. That's just the beginning. In fact,
yeah.
One friend of mine who is a stand-up comic by trade.
Yes.
He received so many rejection letters from agents and publishers that he used them to decorate his office.
Yeah. That's great.
He's a truly funny guy.
Yes.
What was your experience with the publishing world?
You know, it was interesting that you made that connection with, you know, if you build it, they will come. And that's absolutely true. They will come. Unfortunately, they always go to the wrong address. So you don't even know that they have come. They've gone someplace else. So, indeed, you can I went through a process. I actually got a book at Barnes & Noble, and I think it was written by Jeff Herman. And he lists every publisher and every agent in the United States, and I think in Canada as well. And you kind of go through that as kind of a guideline, which is a great source. And I've been told it's kind of like the holy grail of how do you get yourself an agent or how do you get someone published. And they have different, as you go to different agencies, they have different genres they deal with. So obviously if you're reading a biography, writing a biography, you're not going to send to someone who writes or someone who publishes reading books that are for children. So I did that, and it was, it was a momentous, it was kind of like, oh my God, where do you begin? Because there's so many, this book is like 1,000 pages long. So I kind of did glean through the book and found those who would be doing biographies or memoirs. And then I found, and it is an unbelievable process, and it really is discouraging when you do that, because each publisher or each agency has a different criteria as to how you submit what is called a query letter, which is a one-page synopsis of who you are, why this book is going to be a good marketing, a good sell in the market, and what is the book about, all in one page.
Right.
And each of them will have a different criteria, you know, a 3-inch margin on the left, right, whatever it is that they require. So I basically looked at the ones that had said we accept emails as opposed to snail mail, the slow process. And I sent it out to 6 of these. 3 of them I got basic rejections saying thank you for your interest, and it was just a postcard. It was stamped. However, 3 others, they said they were extremely interested in my book and please submit some chapters and to us for our review, and then we'll get back to you. I did hear back from all 3 of them, and those who had actually accepted me to send some, you know, some copies of my manuscript, and all three of them kind of praised my book and said, this is wonderful, but we are actually looking for a different type of biography at this point in time, so that is not our great interest. Please let us know. Please resubmit that, excuse me, in about 6 months to a year, and we'll go over it again. So, it is kind of disheartening. The easy part, I guess, is really writing the book. The difficult part is getting someone to accept it to go forward.
Right. I mean, it's unfortunate that we had not crossed paths a couple of years ago. I would have pointed you at a publisher that I know would have snapped this one up.
Oh.
But, you know, that's water under the bridge.
Well, you should have let me know ahead of time.
Right. I enjoyed Litzy and Fredel a great deal. Where can people buy it?
The book is actually available. You can order it easily on Amazon.com or Barnes and Noble.com. If you were to call a Barnes & Noble store, they can order it for you if you want. I have found that just from patients of mine and people who have contacted me through my website that they've reported that if you actually order it on Amazon.com, you get it in like 2 or 3 days. If you order it through a bookstore, they have to go through their ordering it on the their inventory, and they have to submit it to the home office, and then they have to kind of submit it to the printer, and all of these different things are from their warehouses, and it usually takes about a week to 10 days. If you order it at a bookstore, it's much easier to order it at Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. I know people have said they bought it at Target.com, all of the different larger warehouse-type places. It's readily available. But I think Amazon is the easiest one to get and the quickest way to get it as well.
You mentioned that you have a website.
Yes.
What's the address? Because I'm sure our listeners would love to peruse it.
Sure. It's www.drwilliambstanford.com. That's drwilliambstanford, as in boy, Stanford, stanford.com.
I'll make a point of including that link in my text summary of the interview. So
yeah.
Listeners, just check back on Blogger News in a couple of hours, and all will be revealed.
That would be great. If I might add, I've had lots of people who have had my book at their book clubs for discussion. And I have said to them when they contact me, I said, if you like, as you're reading the book or if you want to discuss it, email me on my website. There's a tab there where you can say email me. And if you email me and give me your address, I would be more than happy to answer what questions may not have been answered within the book itself. And then it becomes an interactive discussion at the book club from the author's point of view or things that I may not have mentioned in the book. That's kind of like little side notes that
right.
are there.
And actually, I came across an author, this was about a month ago, and I had never seen this done in a book before. She'd written essentially a murder mystery, and it was very well done. And at the back of the book, there was just two or three pages dedicated to book clubs,
yes.
saying, here's a list of questions that you might want to ponder.
Correct.
Yeah, I thought that was a fabulous idea.
I currently have a publicist. Her name is Jocelyn Kelly, and she is with Kelly and Hall Publicist in Marblehead, Massachusetts. And they are trying to get my book into the big houses right now, media, and with different types of attention, and trying to get me into some more types of publicity. And that was one of the things that that occurred to me when you had mentioned that I probably, once if there it goes into a reprint, I would love to have that change in the back where we could kind of mention that particular item that you had had said. So that's kind of interesting. One of the interesting things that I found from my website, probably about a month or so back, I received an email from a woman in France who read my book and said this was so wonderful because she lives in France and she knows all of the towns that I mentioned in the book. And she says, as a matter of fact, I live close to Bergerac. Bergerac is a town that becomes very important in the book. I don't want to spoil it for people, but I describe this a little apartment where my mother and her sister Elise were living, and my father and his brother, they didn't know where neither of them knew where the other one was. And just through sheer coincidence or the will of God, they find each other. And they find each other in this little apartment in Bergerac where they have a reunion. So this woman says, I know where this is. And in the book, I actually give the address of Avenue de Verdun, which is the name of the street, numéro 4, which is number 4, Avenue de Verdun. And she said, I'm going to go to Bergerac and see if I can find that house. A few days later, I get an email from her saying, I found it. Avenue de Verdun with numéro 4 is exactly the way you described it in the book. And then she sent me an email with the pictures of this apartment that I had described in the book as it looks in the year 2009, but something that I described in 1940 or 1941.
Wow.
And I was just dumbfounded. So if someone's reading my book and they get to page 183 and 184 where I describe this apartment, email me. I'd be more than happy to send the digital pictures in the body of the email so you can actually view what it looks like today. And I find that fascinating. I've been contacted from on my website from 31 different countries. Just the other day, I got someone of all places that got onto my website from Laos. It's just incredible the response that I've had, and it's very heartwarming to read all of the different discussions about their personal experiences with World War II or the fact that they just loved the book.
Obviously, you are getting lots and lots of positive feedback about this book.
Yes.
I know it's early days, but are you pretty encouraged by sales?
Yes, I am. It's the iUniverse, the publisher, has said that I've reached certain sales where it's going to go into kind of like a different type of category where my book would be in the brick and mortar, as the literary world describes the bookstores.
that
it will have permanent status at bookstores, and that's a big. Of course, I was naive; I didn't know this. But lots of times, if books do not have a certain status, bookstores can't purchase the books because they can't return it if they don't sell. But once it reaches a certain status, the book has returnability status at any time, and so bookstores, if they got 5 books or 10 books of it, and they said, oh, gee, we haven't sold this book in 6 months, we're going to return it, now they can get a full refund themselves. So it has gone on to that level right now. I'm very pleased with what's taken place, and things seem to be breaking rapidly with lots of things, with people such as yourself. I mean, your website is just incredible. I've kind of fallen in love with it since we had touched base a few days or so ago. It's so interesting, and there's so many things on there that that are current news type of things, not the typical fluff pieces that I sometimes hear on on TV and on radio shows where they're just dramatic and there's really nothing to the stories.
Right. But believe it or not, that is a double-edged sword. We spend a lot of time in the trenches as a result of publishing hard news.
Yes, I can imagine.
Not all of it's a good time in the trenches either.
I understand.
But I am so encouraged. I don't know how many books I've reviewed over the years, but it's a huge number, and you're one of the few authors who has said, yes, life is going good. I see bricks and mortar in my future. I mean,
right.
that is such a great thing. I doubt that many of our listeners realize just how many books are published every year. There's a company by the name of Boka who do all things books. They, amongst other things, hand out those strange numbers called ISBNs. And
yes.
I believe in 2008, something like 300,000 new titles were released in the U.S. alone. Now,
wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. Go to your local bookstore and see if they have 300,000 titles.
Yes. Yes.
No, they don't.
Yeah, I remember, as a matter of fact, when I was told that my book would appear in a number of Barnes & Nobles in Orange County in Southern California, I was told that by the publisher, and then when I contacted the bookstore to find out when it was going to take place, they had said, oh, it's going to take, you probably won't see it for another 2 or 3 months, and I thought, 2 or 3 months? I didn't understand. Well, evidently, each of the authors or publishers and or publicists and or agents sign some kind of a contract with different bookstores, and in that contract, it says they have to have a 8-week run or a 12-week run or a 10-week run, and so when your book actually comes out, you are basically in queue waiting for those expiration dates for those books to get off of the shelf and then out of the bookstore, because there's only a finite amount of space in bookstores. And so you
yes.
may have to wait months. So that's, I was totally unaware of that.
Right. The publishing industry really is a rather strange industry. There's something I do want to talk to you about, and we've talked about this before, the Hitler photograph.
Yes.
It's a wonderful photograph, and
yes.
as I understand it, it's never been published before.
That's correct. I have 3 photographs in the book, all of which are part of World War II, and basically Hitler is in each of those photographs. I obtained the photographs from an anonymous, I have to leave this person anonymous,
mm-hmm.
and she came across the photographs and told me of the authenticity of it, and that they were acquired from someone who had an inside, not by choice, but an inside to the inner circles of the Nazi Party, of
mm-hmm.
course, Hitler being the head of that demonic animal. And I was, I promise not to reveal this person's name or where it came from, but I've had lots of people who have read the book, and some of them are history buffs, and some of them are history teachers, and had said, I've never come across these. I've seen every photograph of Adolf Hitler and scenes about that, and these are all new to me. And indeed they are, because up until now they've not been published, and the one in question that you have talked about is a very interesting one.
Right, and again, for our listeners, I will publish a link to an article that I put together about the photograph. To briefly describe it, it shows Hitler sat at a table with a number of what I'm guessing are businessmen. In the background, you can see someone holding what is likely a Nazi flag. There's also a swastika with some lettering on it.
Yes.
And it's a very interesting photograph. It's so interesting that I actually contacted a group called Axis History, who are a bunch of history buffs and collectors. And this is hot off the press. This is a reply I got a couple of hours ago. And the gentleman says, what I see in your picture is Hitler, likely taken before 1933, and most likely before 1930.
Wow.
I'm quite sure it's in Bavaria, probably the Bergen-Burkeller in Munich.
Okay.
You'll hardly find those giant beer cups outside Bavaria.
Interesting.
It seems to be an official Nazi Party event of some smaller kind, as can be guessed by the flag and SA Guard. As the later dictator is wearing a suit, I think it's relatively safe to say these men with Hitler are local businessmen or other influential persons, and they are most definitely party members.
Incredible.
They wear a button. And what else could that be but the NSDAP party membership button? So, yeah. So I'm sure I'll get further updates on this, but there's something about the photograph.
That's incredible. I'm looking forward to talking to my friend who his name is Klaus, and he's from originally from Berlin, and he and his wife Anne Marie were from there originally. And I asked him if he could read what was underneath that picture in question that you had mentioned, and because I do read German, I do speak German, but I could not make that out. But he is much more familiar with it, and the words underneath that says "Wake up." And he said later on, of course, I didn't know the information you just shared with me, but he said later on it was adopted by the Nazis as "Wake up, Germany," you know, "Wake up,"
right.
Which was kind of like perhaps a calling signal to people of Germany that, you know, we have to do something.
So that would dovetail with it,
yes,
being an early photograph.
Yes, I'll see if I can kind of ask him again now with that information, whether or not he might be able to kind of get some background information, and I can certainly submit that back to you, and perhaps you can post that on your website as well.
Oh, I certainly will. A bit of a trick question, and maybe,
yes,
an unfair question.
Yes.
Do we know who the photographer is? Is it Heinrich Hoffmann, who was Hitler's personal photographer?
You know, I have no idea, because the person who submitted the photographs to me for me to use never mentioned the source by name. So I have no idea. And I'm not a historian by nature, so I don't know anything of that. All I know was that he was a photographer that had access to that inner circle during the war.
Right.
And so perhaps maybe he was in that inner, you know, the photographer prior to the war as well, from the information that you're giving me, but I don't know who they are.
Hmm.
Unfortunately.
It truly is a fascinating story, and
yes,
it's one that has certainly caught my interest.
Yeah, well, it seems like an onion right now, and we're just peeling one layer after another until we get to the part where it makes our eyes cry.
Right. We're rapidly running out of time, but
yeah.
I do want to ask you about your new book. I have,
yes,
never known an author that stops at one. I mean, books are like
yes,
crack cocaine. You get,
yes,
you become addicted.
Yes, I'm writing a book right now. I'm about halfway through writing it. It is a murder mystery that takes place in Orange County, California, and it is not a murder mystery that typically is the genres that are being written today, where there's blood, mayhem, and torture. I abhor that type of writing. I don't think it's necessary. I think we have too much of that in TV, and I think we have too much of that in the movies. This is an old-fashioned murder mystery that takes place, and I give you all sorts of clues in the book. You will know early on who is going to be murdered, and you do probably will figure out that it's of one of five people who is the murderer, but it has a twist to it. At the very end, you will be dumbfounded when you find out what this book was about. The red sign is not S-I-G-N, it's S-I-N-E, which is a little tiny insignia that you would use in trigonometry, and this red sign goes throughout the book. And at the very end, when I reveal it to you, and then you will see all of the breadcrumbs that I left, like Hansel and Gretel did, you will say, oh my God, the clues were all over the place, and I never saw it. And you will swear to yourself that you would have thought that Rod Serling of Twilight Zone fame had something to do with the writing of this book, although he was an idol of mine. And so I fashioned it after that type of approach. And from what I've been told from publicists and from writers alike, that what I'm about to do has never been done before in a literary work. So stay tuned, and you can get some more information about that on my website.
Okay, and do we have an idea of the when we might see this book?
Yeah, you know, I've been so inundated with requests such as yourself for, you know, interviews and things like that, that it's kind of slowed me up. So all you people, you know, get off my back a little bit so I can finish writing this. But before I go, can I just kind of say something that I want to thank some family members, because they've kind of lived through this. My two daughters and my one wife. I would like to thank my oldest daughter, Wendy, is an attorney for Rudder Hobbs and Davidoff in Los Angeles, California, and my other daughter is a marketing manager for PricewaterhouseCoopers in New Jersey, and they've been the joys of my life and what I've kind of dedicated my life to, too, which is what my parents did. They dedicated their lives to me and their respective grandchildren, and they were the only two grandchildren that my mother and father had, and my wife, Jan, who happens to also be my office manager in my office in Tustin, California. So I want to say a special thank you to them for all that they had to listen through the years and the guidance they gave me and the support.
And actually, I spoke to your wife, Jan, yesterday. You were you were out on a shopping mission.
Yes.
and she explained that, you know, someone had to keep you organized.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Well, we are right now in Palm Desert, where the temperature, according to my thermometer outside, is 110 degrees. But it's a dry heat. But, of course, chickens are also cooked in the rotisserie ovens that are in a dry heat. And I'm sure they're not thrilled about the dry heat themselves. So 110 is 110. It's hot.
It's hot, yes, indeed. Bill, it has been a sheer delight talking
you so
with
much.
You today.
It has been my pleasure.
And I do hope that I will get an opportunity to review your next book. I'm looking forward to it.
As my mother always said, from your mouth to God's ear. And I feel as though, even though my mom and dad have passed away, they are still present in my life, and I feel their presence. And they've guided me through this first book, and they will guide me, I'm sure, for the rest of my life.
Bill, I really, really want to thank you. This has been delightful, and I'm sure I speak for everyone at Blogger News in wishing you every success in the literary world.
Thank you. I will
definitely be keeping an eye out for you.
Well, you'll see this on the big screen or the little screen someday. In my heart, I know that's going to happen, so stay tuned, as they say.
Okay. This is Simon Barrett for Blogger News Network signing off. We will have another show in a couple of days' time, and I want to wish everyone a very happy Monday. So goodbye for now.